The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles, at least initially, from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And this is the April 2024 issue of the Women's Health Watch. And the first article is entitled, Afraid to Visit the Doctor? You're not alone if medical anxiety is endangering your health. Even after many years of seeing Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Maggie could best be described as a reluctant patient. She was deathly afraid of doctors and hospitals and very anxious every time she came in. But she knew she had to sometimes, Dr. Sands recalls. But Maggie's hesitancy cost her dearly, preventing her from getting care that might have kept her healthier and stronger. She skipped vaccinations against illnesses that could worsen her chronic lung disease. And although she had terrible arthritis in her knees, she refused to even consider joint replacement surgery to make her more comfortable and mobile. Maggie, whose name has been changed to protect her privacy, is a prime example of medical anxiety, a sometimes crippling fear of doctors and medical settings. It's a pervasive issue. In 2023, nearly half of American adults report feeling anxious before a doctor's appointment, an increase from 39% the previous year. According to a nationally representative survey of 2,000 people by market research company OnePoll, Dr. Sands sees patients with medical anxiety once or twice a month and encounters a severe case like Maggie's a few times a year. But 4 in 10 adults polled in 2023 said their anxiety compels them to put off seeing a doctor, a decision with potentially wide-ranging health implications. Why is healthcare hesitancy dangerous? It can dissuade people from seeking ongoing monitoring, like cholesterol and blood pressure checks, or cancer screenings, like mammograms and colorectal exams. Such anxiety can even stop some people from taking care of serious issues that might shorten their lives. So much of what we do depends on follow-up. Dr. Sands says, if you miss a cancer screening, you have a higher risk of developing cancer. With uncontrolled high blood pressure, you could have a stroke or a heart attack or develop kidney or heart failure. Poorly controlled diabetes greatly increases the risk of heart attack, kidney failure, blindness, and even amputations. Depending on what the problem is, all those things are at play, he says. At worst, you could die before your time. Medical anxiety differs from health anxiety or hypochondria, which involves an extreme preoccupation with developing serious illness, such as cancer, heart problems, or neurologic illness. But it may overlap with white coat hypertension, a surge in blood pressure experienced by 30% of people when measured during a doctor's visit, according to the American Heart Association. For these folks, white coat hypertension is essentially a fight-or-flight response marked by an increase in stress hormones. The trigger might be the stress of getting to the doctors or just the sight of a doctor. The reaction is named for the traditional white lab coat many clinicians wear. It might be the antiseptic smell of a doctor's office, and for some people, it might just be being touched. People who have undergone trauma or abuse may be especially prone to medical anxiety. What else can provoke fear? Needles or shots are on the list, along with the prospect of a painful test or procedure, or receiving bad news or a serious diagnosis. Those latter two reasons were cited by 40% of the 2023 poll respondents who reported medical anxiety. Anxiety about medical care doesn't usually exist in a vacuum. Dr. Sands says, people with it often have generalized anxiety that also crops up outside of healthcare settings. In my experience, going to the doctor only makes it worse, he says. Dr. Sands recommends that people with medical anxiety seek treatment, which may include psychotherapy, medication, or both. These kinds of situations often call for professional help. He offers additional coping strategies if doctors or medical settings make you anxious. Identify what it is that worries you. Doing so may take its power away or prod ideas about how to respond. If you can identify your triggers, you can try to talk yourself through them, he says, but you should also share them with your doctor. If your doctor doesn't ask, say, these are things that make me concerned or anxious. Do a cost-benefit analysis. Weigh the long-term health benefits of getting needed health care against your short-term discomfort. This is perhaps easier said than done when you're anxious, Dr. Sands acknowledged. Bring someone along. Having a trusted companion at your side during your appointment can calm frayed nerves. Request sedatives. Short-acting medications may help you to stay more relaxed during anxiety-provoking procedures, but they can also involve drawbacks, like being unable to drive afterwards. For more involved, longer procedures, your doctor may have the option to perform them under anesthesia. Using either sedative or anesthetic involves carefully weighing the risks and benefits. Ask your doctors about the pros and cons. Try relaxation techniques. Meditation or deep breathing can help allay anxiety while you're in the waiting room. It's a great way to relax and bring your blood pressure down. And then there's a short related article, again in the Harvard Women's Health Watch. It's entitled, Does Asking for a Second Opinion Insult Your Doctor? If your home needed a new roof, you might get quotes from several companies before making a weighty financial decision. So why wouldn't you seek advice from more than one doctor if you're facing a weighty medical matter? Seeking a second opinion is very common, but some people are concerned that doctors would be insulted by the request, though they shouldn't be, says Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Patients should feel comfortable asking for a second opinion, Dr. Sands says. It shouldn't be a personal affront or a matter of ego to the doctor. It should be a matter of being open to hearing what another health professional says. Most situations don't call for a second opinion. You don't need one for a minor health problem, and if you're pleased with your care, you don't need to ask another doctor if they would approach it differently. But wanting a second opinion doesn't necessarily mean you don't trust your doctor. In certain situations, it's just wise to do, especially if you need major surgery or cancer treatment. For any life-changing diagnosis or potentially fatal condition, a second opinion is called for. Cancer is a good example, since there may be more than one way to treat it, so it might be worthwhile to get information from two or three separate places. If you feel trepidation about asking for a second opinion, Dr. Sands offers this approach. Ideally, I'd say, I appreciate the time you spent with me and the thought you've put into this. I think you'll understand why I'd like to get a second opinion. Is there someone you recommend I consult with? A lot of times they'll point you towards someone specific, he says. If you're uncomfortable with that tactic, Dr. Sands suggests speaking with your primary care doctor and asking for her guidance. She can help set up a second opinion, he says. If your doctor does seem insulted by your request, you don't need to confront her, but you should still follow your instincts. End your appointment in a normal way and seek a second opinion elsewhere, Dr. Sands says. And now continuing with the Harvard Women's Health Watch, here's a section called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Tony Golan, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And the question is, how can I protect my eyes during a solar eclipse? A total solar eclipse is scheduled to cross North America on April 8th. How can I view it safely? You're smart to plan ahead, since viewing a solar eclipse, which happens when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, may damage your eyesight if your eyes aren't protected. The light emitted from a solar eclipse isn't stronger than that from sunlight on an ordinary day, but we shouldn't gaze directly at the sun at any time. Looking at the sun's rays without eye protection can lead to solar retinopathy. The injury to the retina includes symptoms like blurry or distorted vision, blind spots, and headaches. These can show up any time from a few minutes to a few days later. The best thing to do is to purchase special solar eclipse glasses. They're available online, but look specifically for versions with an internationally accepted standard code, ISO 12312-2, that indicates the glasses have the correct filtration needed to protect your eyes. Even wearing solar eclipse glasses doesn't guarantee the activity carries no risk. If you view the eclipse and notice any visual problems, get your eyes checked by an ophthalmologist. And then here's a second question for Ask the Doctor with Dr. Golan. My mother, who was in her 80s, recently died after a bout with pneumonia. When I received her death certificate, it listed her cause of death as sepsis. What does that mean? Sepsis occurs when a germ releases dangerous substances or the immune system overreacts to the infection. In this case, your mother had pneumonia, a serious lung infection. Most likely, her immune system roared into action to fight it. But this overwhelming response went awry by progressing into septic shock. This is a dramatic drop in blood pressure that can damage the lungs, the kidneys, the liver, and other vital organs and lead to death. An estimated 1.7 million American adults develop sepsis every year, and 270,000 die, according to the CDC. Like your mother, other older adults are more prone to sepsis. So are people who've recently had surgery or have a chronic illness, an artificial joint, or other surgical device in their body, or a suppressed immune system due to illness or treatment. These folks should go to an emergency room if they develop symptoms, including high fever, palpitations from an elevated heart rate, shortness of breath, and lightheadedness due to low blood pressure. Anyone else who develops these symptoms and has an infection, whether bacterial, viral, or fungal, should call their doctor or seek medical evaluation immediately as well. Now here's another article from the Harvard Women's Health Watch about a subject that at least we see a lot of commercials about, the wide-ranging effects of psoriasis. This common disorder poses challenges that run far deeper than the skin. Decades ago, advertisements waxed on about the heartbreak of psoriasis, a skin condition marked by noticeable patches of scaly skin, to the point that even people with garden variety dry skin or dandruff worried they might also have the condition. But public perception of psoriasis hasn't kept pace with the greatly expanded arsenal of effective treatments scientists have developed in recent years. Numbering more than 8 million in the United States and 125 million worldwide, people with psoriasis still face other people's fear and misperceptions about their skin changes. While it may seem like a skin-deep problem, psoriasis is a complicated disorder rooted in the immune system. It causes skin cells to multiply up to 10 times faster than normal, leading to itchy and painful plaques that can show up in any area of the body. These lesions can lead to sweeping physical and psychological effects, influence what people wear, how often they leave their homes, and even their sex lives, says Dr. Martina Porter, a dermatologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. People generally know psoriasis patients can have a rash, but I'm not sure everyone understands how truly distressing the disease can be, says Dr. Porter, who is also director of the hospital's Clinical Laboratory for Epidemiology and Applied Research in Skin. A lot of people think, oh, it's just your skin. But obviously these people have never had a skin disease like this. Embarrassment is the predominant emotion. Helping dispel some of the stigma are current-day TV commercials for psoriasis medications featuring celebrities with the disorder, as well as organizations like the National Psoriasis Foundation, which runs awareness campaigns to educate the public. The commercials have definitely helped, Dr. Porter says. Now when people hear you have psoriasis, they're less likely to believe it's contagious. But when they see it, they're still somewhat alarmed. It continues to alarm patients as well. Nearly 6 in 10 people with psoriasis report it's a significant problem in their everyday lives, and the effects are even greater in women, according to the NPF. Indeed, women with psoriasis are more likely to deal with depression than men. Some people avoid divulging their symptoms to family members and friends or explaining how the disease pummels their confidence, body image, and relationships. Psoriasis plaques located on the face or genitals, under the breasts, or between the buttocks can make intimacy especially off-putting. In a small 2021 study in the journal Dermatology and Therapy, psoriasis patients reported less satisfaction with their physical appearance and sex lives than people without the condition. It changes how you dress and where you go, Dr. Porter says. Many people with psoriasis also feel uncomfortable having personal relationships or staying overnight because their skin sheds off over couches and beds. It can be hard to explain that you have psoriasis and not some contagious disease. How can you better cope with the physical and psychological ramifications of psoriasis? Dr. Porter offers these suggestions. Make it a family affair. I always tell patients the best way to treat anything is to have a family member involved. With psoriasis, that means they can help apply creams to your skin, pick up medications, or come to the doctor with you to discuss your treatment options. See a dermatologist. Maybe you relied on your primary care doctor to diagnose and treat your psoriasis. That's fine. But if your symptoms aren't responding to topical remedies or are becoming so overwhelming and frustrating that they're disrupting your life, ask for a referral to a dermatologist who can assess your situation and determine if systemic therapies can help, she says. Take a fresh look at available treatments. Options have expanded dramatically in just the last several years, including an array of biologic drugs, which target parts of the immune system responsible for psoriasis. So it's wise to revisit what may work for you now. Seek support. Visit the NPF website or those of the other advocacy groups to learn more about psoriasis and connect with other people who have the disease. It helps you to understand you're not alone. And the NPF website is www.psoriasis.org. Now, continuing with the Harvard Women's Health Watch, here's a section called Research We're Watching. Toothbrushing is tied to lower pneumonia rates. Seriously ill hospitalized patients whose teeth are brushed at least twice daily are far less likely to develop pneumonia, the most common hospital-acquired infection, a new analysis suggests. The study, published online in December of 2023 by JAMA Internal Medicine, reviewed 15 earlier analyses involving a total of 2,800 patients. 14 studies were conducted in hospital intensive care units, while 13 involved patients on ventilators. Patients whose teeth were brushed twice or more daily were 33% less likely to develop hospital-acquired pneumonia than those without a toothbrushing regimen. Patients whose teeth were brushed also needed ventilators for less time, were able to leave the ICU more quickly, and were less likely to die in the ICU than those without a toothbrushing regimen. Since hospital-acquired pneumonia, which kills more people than any other healthcare-associated infection, is largely due to inhaling germs from the mouth and throat, toothbrushing may reduce its incidence by eradicating some of those germs. Then the next brief article is, eating high-quality carbohydrates may stave off middle-aged weight gain. Hoping to avoid middle-aged weight gain, steer clear of low-quality carbohydrates and starchy vegetables like peas, corn, and potatoes, a new Harvard-led study suggests. The study, published online September 27, 2023, by the BMJ, evaluated weight changes in 136,432 adults, 65 or younger, who were tracked for 28 years. Although participants gained an average of more than 3 pounds every 4 years, the quality of carbohydrates they ate appeared to play a role in weight control. A daily increase of 3.5 ounces of low-quality carbohydrates, like sugar-sweetened drinks, refined grains, and starchy vegetables, was associated with gaining up to 3 pounds over a 4-year period. But an increase of just 1/3 of an ounce of fiber in participants' daily diet was linked with gaining 1.7 fewer pounds over 4 years. The associations were especially strong in women and in people with excess body weight. While consuming too much sugar is unhealthy, refined carbohydrates like white pasta, white bread, white rice, and chips appear more problematic, contributing even more to middle-aged weight gain, study authors said. And then the final article in the section called Research We're Watching, night owls may face higher diabetes risk. Women who are night owls have a higher risk of developing diabetes and are more likely to practice unhealthful lifestyle habits compared with early birds, a new analysis suggests. In the Harvard-led study, published online September 12, 2023, by the Annals of Internal Medicine, researchers tracked 64,000 female nurses aged 45 to 62 over 8 years. The women had no history of cancer, cardiovascular disease, or diabetes. Participants reported lifestyle behaviors that included diet quality, physical activity, alcohol use, body mass index, smoking, and sleep habits. They also reported whether they were diagnosed with diabetes. Women who fit an evening chronotype, preferring to stay up and wake up later, were 19% more likely to develop diabetes than those with a morning chronotype, who preferred to go to bed and wake up earlier. Additionally, night owls were 54% more likely than early birds to report unhealthy lifestyle behaviors like smoking and poor sleep habits. Earlier research has also suggested that shorter or irregular sleep is linked with the higher risk of diabetes, the study authors noted. They theorized that circadian misalignment, being a night owl, for example, but also working early morning shifts, which is common in nursing, could disrupt the body's ability to properly process sugars. And of course, they concluded that night owls are more likely than early birds to develop diabetes. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.